MacCast, Tuesday, April 25th, 2017. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, looking over everything we've got in today's episode, it should be a pretty decent show, I think. Hopefully it's a great show. I think we want to put out great shows here on the MacCast, but you know what I'm saying. There's not been a whole lot going on in the Apple Mac community. And I know I say that every week, and then it turns out there's actually a lot to say. And there's some things to talk about. We're going to talk about iPhones and potential delays. We are going to get into some Apple Store news and updates. Also updates on some of Apple's original TV content. And also, Apple is stepping things up, it looks like, in the augmented reality, virtual reality area. There were some hires and some things going on there we're going to get into. We're going to look at next generation technology, maybe for iPhones. And then we're going to move on to some of your feedback. I need to talk to you about probably the biggest topic I've ever received feedback on here at the MacCast, something we covered in the last episode. I heard from a lot of you about one particular subject. So we're going to get into that. A little bit of a mystery that I need you to help me solve related to photos this week. And we're going to talk with Gary about iOS screen sharing. And then I'm going to share a little story about some Apple Watch troubleshooting that I think I shared on another podcast, but I realized I didn't share here on the MacCast. So it should be a pretty good show. Stay tuned for all of that. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Harry's. I've been, and I think I mentioned this before, I've been a Harry's customer since 2014. They have been helping me get a really great shave for a little better than 3 years now. And the reason that I love Harry's, besides just the quality of the product, is really the convenience. I mean, I literally have not purchased a razor blade or shaving cream or anything in a store, convenience store, or a grocery store, anything like that, in those 3 years. I always have the supplies I need, and what's great is I have them when I need them. So with Harry's, when I'm ready and I need a fresh blade, I just have it available. It's there. It's here in the house. I don't have to worry about it, and it comes on my schedule, and I never have to leave the house to go get fresh razor blades. And I love that part of the service. I know it sounds like a simple thing, but it really is such a joy to not have to worry about that. And I love the fact that I can completely tailor the schedule to meet my needs. Everybody's going to have a different shaving schedule, and I know how frequently that I shave and when I'm going to need new blades, and so I can go into my Harry's settings and just change that. And if I need more all of a sudden, I can tweak that up or tweak it down. It doesn't really matter. And when I'm getting close to running out of shaving cream, I just throw that in as an added-on extra. If I need more blades, maybe I'm going to go on a trip and I want a bigger supply, I can just adjust that. And you may be different. Maybe you need a few blades every week. You can adjust the plan to meet your schedule. And it really is affordable. You know, it comes at an affordable price, less than $2 per blade. Compare that to what you're paying now, and you're going to see you're going to get some significant savings there. And they have great quality. Five German-engineered blades, a lubricating strip, the flexible hinge, a trimmer blade for your sideburns and other hard-to-reach places, and it comes with a great weighted ergonomic handle. And the founders were so obsessed about getting a great shave, they literally bought a factory. So you really could ask for more. And they are so confident in the quality of their blades that they're going to let you try it completely free. You get their most popular trial set for free. It comes with a razor handle of your choice, a 5-blade cartridge, and shaving gel. It really is an amazing kit. It comes in an amazing Apple-like packaging. I love how Harry's presents everything. I love their handles. I even upgraded to the higher end chrome Winston handle a few years ago, and I really, really like that. But it's free when you sign up. You just pay a small amount for shipping, and they will send you out your kit right away. And if you haven't taken advantage of their free trial offer yet, what are you waiting for? Do it now. Harrys.com/MacCast. That's Harrys.com/MacCast. And you could have a great shave in just a few days. That's Harrys.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to them for their support of the show. Well, if you're wondering about when you're going to get your new iPhone, I'm going to tell you right now, it's not looking good for the next upgrade. Apple will ship a new iPhone this year. I'm pretty certain of that. But when, how, and how many they're going to have available is really up for debate right now. It's looking like your odds of getting a premium top-end iPhone 8 before 2018, it's getting grim, folks. Grimmer every day. There are still supply chain reports that seem to indicate Apple is ramping up production or trying to ramp up production. They actually want to have a lot of iPhones available. We have a report saying that they've more than doubled their ordering for the last two quarters of this year. So reportedly, they are ordering enough chips and components to build about 50 million iPhones in the third and fourth quarter, so 100 million iPhones total. That would be plenty of supply. And Apple is reportedly putting a lot of pressure on all of their suppliers, including ADI and Broadcom and Cirrus Logic, Cypress, basically all the chip guys, Qualcomm, ST Microelectronics, TSMC, TI, all those guys are getting the pressure from Apple to get components into the supply chain so Apple can make a ton of phones. But here's the rub. It seems like Apple's still having some supply issues, some constraint issues, yield issues on a number of components. So it's not just chips that are going to these things. We need things like OLED screens. Apple's going to put a new OLED display in there, and it has all this kind of new technology in there, and that is causing the bulk of the supply chain issues. At least that's what KGI analyst Ming-Chi Kuo thinks. And he thinks it's bad enough that he has pushed back the launch estimate window from September, October to October, November. Now, he does still think those S series models. So it's expected that Apple's going to, and we've talked about this on the show, that they're going to be putting out a iPhone 7S and an iPhone 7S Plus. Those are going to be fine. So updated versions of those models, but the new iPhone, what I'm calling the iPhone Edition or the iPhone 8, the premium high-end phone with all the great new features, that is the one that's going to be delayed. And he doesn't just blame the OLED display. He says all of the, quote, significant hardware upgrades are causing problems. And that includes things like the updated A-Series A11 processor, the new 3D touch modules that are going into it, the 3D sensing cameras. He also expects that the OLED shortage, that's actually going to plague Apple through the end of the year. So even when and if Apple does ship iPhones in October and November, you can expect that they're going to be severely supply constrained, which is why I'm saying, you know, the idea of getting an iPhone 8 before 2018, it's looking grim. This is going to be one of the worst, I think, pre-order evenings ever, because demand is going to be higher than ever. We've been hearing that there's more people looking to upgrade phones this year, and it's looking like supplies are going to be really short. So just prepare yourself now. That's all I'm saying. And Nikkei, they're saying Apple's also having a problem, unfortunately, with the new wireless charging system and possibly with overheating issues. So that is not something you want at all, especially considering we're in the wake of the whole Samsung phone issue with batteries and fires and all those sorts of things. You don't want your shiny new iPhone 8 getting hot. So Apple's trying to resolve and work through all those issues. What I really hope is that they just delay things. I would rather have a product shipping out that is a good quality product, even though it's late and you're going to have disappointed customers up front, but I think it's much worse if you try and force ship a product out the door and then your users start to experience all of these negative issues and you're getting returns and you're dealing with that at the same time you're trying to get your supply chain to get, it just would be a mess. And I think Apple and Tim Cook and the team, they know this. They're not going to make that mistake. They would rather err on the side of let's wait a little bit longer to get these things into the market. Maybe they'll be supply constrained, but at least we know we can keep a handle on quality control and all of those sorts of things. That's typically Apple's, the way Apple runs it. So I think that is going to be the way that they're going to go. As far as, oh, and one other thing Ming-Chi Kuo mentioned that is going to affect that demand as well is he's saying, you know, the iPhone 7S models, the LED designs, they're kind of moving into this territory of being a little bit less desirable, especially for early adopters, people who are going for the premium phones, because the entire industry is moving to larger bezel-free OLED designs like we're hearing the iPhone 8 is going to be. So from Apple and other vendors, everybody really wants, those are the phones, the hot new phones that people are going to want. That's where the demand goes. So even if Apple does ship out updated S series, they're not going to have the kind of demand that the iPhone 8 is. And there was one kind of sketchy report this week that I wanted to point out coming out of China that claimed Apple was only developing two new models of the iPhone, both iPhone 8 edition style models with that design. But that looks not likely. It's kind of an edge case, an outlier. But if you read about that one, I would give that almost no chance of being actually what Apple ends up doing. Now, as far as the final design goes, we're at a point where now we would expect to be starting to see some parts. And we are a little bit, but the details are kind of iffy and sketchy. It seems like a lot of what's going on is we're starting to see iPhone backs and blanks and CNC'd mock-ups this week. A lot of it is turning out to be renders that people are trying to pass off as actual component parts. And again, this I think is because Apple is a little bit delayed. Normally they would be in production of those components right now, but everything's pushed back a month or two. So expect to start to see real bits and pieces in about a month or two, but still some interesting things did show up this week. Sonny Dixon, a fairly reliable leaker, showed off an iPhone 7-esque design of an iPhone 8 model. It was much more in line with, actually, even more an iPhone 5-esque design, I would say, with kind of the square chamfered corners, metal back. The component he showed off actually had a Touch ID sensor hole on the back. It did have the dual vertical lens camera that we've been talking about, and that's one consistent piece in a lot of the rumors that seems to be coming up over and over. So I'm starting to really believe that there is going to be a vertical orientation on the dual lens camera system, and we talked about this a little bit on the last show. I think it's really designed to help with some of the 3D sensing technology and the stereoscopic kind of viewing technology that Apple is reportedly putting into this next phone. Now, the Sonny Dixon image looks very similar to a rendering based on schematics leaked by another leaker, Benjamin Geskin. And we saw a lot of stuff from this guy this week. I hadn't encountered him before, but supposedly he's somebody that builds a lot of comps. He's watching the supply chain. And he also was the source this week of what was being called a dummy model of the iPhone, and it looks more like the original design of the iPhone, or at least inspired by the original design of the iPhone. What he showed off was a metal back, much more rounded than the current design, with an all-glass, almost all edge-to-edge display front, no Touch ID sensor cutout on the back. It looked very much like a polished stainless steel back, like think of the stainless steel Apple Watch, and just turn that into a 4.7-inch phone, and you have a pretty good idea of what this thing looks like. Although he did point out that that was ultimately going to be made into a jet or space, he called it space black color, but I'm thinking more like the jet glossy black, or the black stainless steel Apple Watch is another thing you could kind of think of for reference. It looks like that in an iPhone form factor. Very gorgeous, very beautiful, almost no holes on the front display, or at least visible holes on the front display. And supposedly this was a part that came out of Foxconn. It was a machined part. Whether it's the actual part that will ultimately be the iPhone 8, it could just be some mock-ups of some designs. And I think a lot of that, a lot of things we're seeing right now, really the reason there's some discrepancy in what the actual thing might look like is I think we're still seeing mock-up designs, and Apple maybe hasn't even totally finalized the design just because of where they're at with some of the component parts suppliers. They may need to make some last-minute, you know, down-to-the-wire changes in the design to actually get these things out in the fall. But once again, edge-to-edge display, no Touch ID sensor on the back. I really think that's the direction Apple wants to move in. The vertical camera. All these designs also do have this, they're calling it kind of an elongated sleep-wake button. The power button is much taller, and I'm not really sure why that is or if that would ultimately be an advantage or not. The other thing about the Geskin leaked dummy model is he did say it has about the same thickness of the iPhone 7, about the same physical dimensions of an iPhone 7, but obviously with a much bigger display like we've been hearing about. And then he followed that leak up with a leak that he called about 70% accurate of an internal motherboard design. And it was very interesting, a very tiny motherboard, kind of an L shape right up above the SIM slot. And then almost the entire remaining sort of cavity of the iPhone is a battery, a larger battery, also an L-shaped battery. You do have some additional components and chips for the Touch ID sensor and some of the speakers and things along the bottom of the phone, but mostly battery and even smaller motherboard. And actually, that is another one of the components that is being reported as to causing Apple some trouble. They continue to try and shrink the motherboard down, and that means smaller chips and new designs and all that sort of stuff. So all of these things going to kind of slow down the launch of this iPhone. So just, again, prepare yourself, be ready for that. And I think we're going to hear more and more about this. I just hope that the date doesn't slip into 2018. But I also hope that if Apple needs to do that, that they are willing, ready and willing to actually make that call. As disappointed as a lot of us would be, because we'd like to see an iPhone in the fall. And if you did this week see the supposed Geekbench numbers claiming that it was an iPhone 8, they were showing incredible performance gains with the new processor, single-core speed bumps of nearly 30%, multi-core speed bumps of up to 50%. Well, don't believe everything you see. 9to5 Mac was actually able to confirm with the developers of the Geekbench software that those screenshots definitely were doctored. So fake screenshots, those things are going to get out there, and we'll try and point them out when we come across them. Because I know as you're reading Mac news blogs and stuff like that, you're seeing these things, and you get excited. If you're like me, you get excited. You're like, yeah, that would be amazing. We can expect some pretty good speed bumps, I think, from the next generation processors. What they're actually going to be and how the performance is going to be, you know, we're going to have to wait a little bit longer. It seems a little bit too early for Apple to be actually testing that and for that to be showing up in Geekbench numbers. And then one final thing kind of related to iPhone. This week, Apple did their environmental responsibility report. There was a bunch of environmental reports going on. Apple's doing a great job. I think they've got like 93% of their facilities running on renewable energy. But they added something to this report that was pretty interesting, sort of a goal, something they're trying to do. They set a goal of wanting to manufacture 100% of their devices out of recycled materials when it comes to materials that would normally be mined. So metals and things like that, they want to reuse, repurpose materials. And if you remember the Liam dismantling robot that they showed off, I think that was at a WWDC, a Worldwide Developer Conference video, that really cool robot that completely disassembles all of the parts and components of an iPhone so that they can more easily recycle them. Apple, you know, that's, I think, a big part of this plan to get materials that they can reuse. And Apple even pointed out that the metals, aluminum, and things like that, that they get now, it can't be mixed. They use a higher grade of certain materials, and so they need, if they're going to reuse that stuff in new phones and in new products, they need that higher grade. So dismantling those things, those old iPhones, and doing it in a way where they can reuse those materials is going to be very important. I think that's part of what Liam was all about. I think they have a pair of those Liam robots right now, and I've been reading currently they're capable of dismantling about 2.4 million phones a year. And if you were paying attention earlier, you probably noted that I said Apple is planning to make about 50 million iPhones a quarter. So they're going to need a pretty big army of Liam robots to actually do all the disassembly. But it's a goal that they've set for themselves. I think it's a great goal. Whether or not they'll ever be able to pull it off, that remains to be seen. But it's something certainly to shoot for. There were no details or timeline given for the transition or when they will be moving off or moving into more recycled materials being in phones. They use some now, but they're planning to use a whole lot more in the future. As I mentioned at the top of the show, there was a lot of news this week related to Apple stores. Let's start off with the New York City, the iconic Fifth Avenue Glass Cube store. A little bit of a panic ensued this week because there were some permits that Apple had filed for removing the glass cube. That store has been undergoing a renovation. They have a temporary store set up at the old FAO Schwartz building, I think a couple blocks away or fairly close by. But they had permits to remove the glass cube, so that's going to be coming down. And there was no word on what they were planning to change or if they were going to replace the structure. So a lot of people were concerned Apple was getting rid of the glass cube. The last time they actually did a removal of the glass cube, it was actually to do an upgrade. They changed the design from 90 glass panels to just 15. They had improved their glass manufacturing technology, and they were able to use less panels. The cost to remove the cube this time around is going to be about $2 million to Apple. But what's going on is Apple is actually doubling the size of that store. That store is open 365 days a year, 24/7. I've been in there. It is packed, and it is always packed from what I've read. So they're trying to open up more space. They're moving from approximately 32,000 square feet to 77,000 square feet. And so my best guess is that the removal is likely so that they can get equipment and things in to do the expansion, because that entire facility is underground. And that big hole in the ground is probably the best place to get supplies and giant machines and equipment into there. I'm thinking they're pulling it down while they're doing construction, and I'm pretty sure that glass cube is going back up. Now, 9to5 did find one interesting possible reason for the glass cube removal, and I could buy this. They said that they ran across some plans made by Norman Foster, which is Apple's architects, that show a staircase designed for the NYC store, the Fifth Avenue store, that is ceramic. Right now they have the iconic glass staircase, but this would be the white ceramic material that Apple lately has been very fond of. We have the white ceramic edition iPhone, and we've had rumors that Apple wanted to do a white ceramic version of the iPhone at some point. So you have the white ceramic Apple Watch edition. I might have just said iPhone edition. I have to go back and listen to that. But I meant the Apple Watch. So them doing a white ceramic staircase, that could be another big reason to remove the cube so that they could install that new staircase. And again, I don't think we have a lot to worry about in terms of the design of that store. I can't imagine Apple changing it. It was one of the first stores, the most iconic ones out there. And I don't think they're really going to mess with that, especially not in New York City. But they're not just stopping with the New York City store. Apple is actually going to be expanding and upgrading and redesigning all of their stores. They've been going through this. The designs are going to be based on the design that Apple pioneered at their new Union Square location in San Francisco. About 100 of Apple's largest retail stores are actually going to get some of the redesign elements, like live trees and meeting spaces, the big giant screens similar to the one that's in San Francisco. They're going to be renaming the Genius Bar the Genius Grove to reflect the trees. I think they call the accessories area something like the Promenade. Basically, the concept is they're trying to turn the Apple stores more into kind of a town square feel. The idea is they would be a place where people would come to meet and hang out and have conversations, and also potentially learn, because another big initiative that they announced this week is that they're going to be expanding their Today at Apple education sessions. These, again, were pioneered at the Apple Union Square store, and they're going to be expanding them to all 495 of their retail stores worldwide starting in May. And these are free classes that you can sign up for, you can go to. They offer more than 60 different kind of hands-on sessions, most of them focused in the creative skills area, like skills areas like photography, videography, music. There is some coding, art, design, and a lot of the classes are run by Apple's creative pros. And if you don't know what a creative pro is, Apple's had creative pros in their retail stores for a long time. They're basically the creative version of an Apple genius. And so they're going to be running a lot of these classes. Apple also says they're planning on bringing in world-class artists, photographers, and musicians at some of their locations to run some of the sessions. And they're trying to target all different skill levels and ages. So there's going to be something kind of for everyone. They're doing something called Teacher Tuesdays for teachers. There's going to be a kids hour for your kids. And so again, they're really trying to make the Apple store an event kind of space, a place where people come to congregate, to meet, to hang out. The stores are already kind of like that, but now they're making these changes to make them more inviting in terms of the seating, opening them up, making them feel more like inside, outside, and it should be pretty neat. All of the stores are going to be getting updated seating and sound systems to support the new Today at Apple programs and large displays created specifically for these sessions. So expect a lot of changes to be happening at your Apple retail store soon. And one other Apple store that is getting the new treatment, because it's a new store, Apple will be opening up a location at the Dubai Mall on April 27th. And one of its big features is it has a giant curved glass wall in front of it that is pretty gorgeous. So for those of you in that region of the world, or if you ever travel there, you might want to check out that new Apple store. It looks like it's going to be a really nice one. Apple reported this week another delay, unfortunately, in one of their big initiatives to bring their first original content series to Apple Music. Carpool Karaoke seems to be stuck in traffic. Yeah, I know it's a bad pun, but I had to do it. And this is the second time, supposedly, it has been delayed. Originally, there was a launch party set for March. Then it was rumored there was going to be a launch party here in April. Now we're hearing that Apple says the show will air sometime, quote unquote, later this year. Apple's working with CBS Television on the project, and they also issued a separate press release about the delay, basically saying exactly the same thing, that it's delayed till later this year. They didn't explain why or offer when it will actually be releasing. So expect it sometime in 2017, but beyond that, we really don't know. And for Apple's version of the show, what they're planning on doing is changing. If you ever saw Carpool Karaoke before, it was basically, and yes, Doc Rock, I know I'm saying it wrong, but basically it was these little short segments that would air, and they need to move those into half-hour episodes. They're going to feature 16 half-hour episodes with rotating celebrity guests and hosts. The original shorts were actually hosted by James Corden. He's an executive producer on the new program and will likely appear in some, but probably not all of the episodes. So they're changing it up. Who knows if they've kind of hit some scheduling problems or what's happening, but it is going to be a little bit of a different show from what you may have seen before. And that seems to be par for the course for what's happening with Apple's original video content. A lot of people are wondering, especially in the industry, what Apple is up to. There have been many different reports, and there was a report earlier this week that called Apple's original video content efforts, quote unquote, scattershot, that there doesn't seem to be any clear leader in charge, or it's really curious what the direction might be. I remember hearing reports that Eddie Q and Jimmy Iovine were kind of giving different conflicting information or doing different deals with different partners and talent, and it was a little bit confusing. And many have reported having meetings with Apple, different media executives and companies, have gone in, met with Apple, and left meetings feeling confused about exactly what Apple's strategy in the space is going to be. I half wonder if this is by design. I have a hard time believing that Apple doesn't have a plan for their video efforts and their original content efforts. It sounds at the very least like they're starting to solidify, because the last thing we heard about this week related to this was a rumor that Apple might be looking at getting some office space in Los Angeles, probably to help run their original programming and content efforts. It makes sense to be in Hollywood in the LA area, and they do seem to be looking at an office space or a couple different office spaces and maybe adding additional staff around this. So I would fully expect that Apple is right on top of this, and I wouldn't worry about it too much, despite maybe some of the things we're hearing in the rumor mill. The other area that we've been talking about a lot that Apple seems to be ramping up in is augmented reality. This week, according to Bloomberg, they said earlier this year, as a matter of fact, Apple hired a guy named Jeff Norris, who actually founded the Mission Operations Innovation Office at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratories, and he has been brought on board to be part of Apple's AR and virtual reality team, according to reports. Now, when he was at NASA, the lab he built was actually developed to create new ways to control spacecraft and robots in space with virtual reality and augmented reality technologies. So this seems like a perfect fit. And the piece says he is going to be on the team that is working on a pair of augmented reality glasses and related features that will be part of an accessory or integration into future versions of the iPhone. The report claims that Apple hopes to bring augmented reality technology hardware to market as soon as 2018. I don't think they have a hard deadline at this point, but they are trying to shoot for maybe sometime in 2018. And Tim Cook has been pretty public about his excitement about augmented reality technology. Apple also recently hired a guy named Tim Dashwood. He was the developer of a Final Cut Pro 10 plugin for creating virtual reality videos called VR 360 Toolbox. The future of that plugin is kind of unknown, whether Apple will continue to develop it. It's not clear. Dashwood did make that app available for free for anyone to download. So if you want to check it out and you're a Final Cut Pro person, you can get that. But it's not likely you'll see any future updates to the app. It seems like Dashwood is going to be doing other things. It's not clear at this point what his role is going to be at Apple, but he could be developing tools for Final Cut. More likely, though, it's sounding like he could be joining that augmented reality team or be used in some other role at Apple. And then another recent hire, this one probably not related to augmented reality, potentially could be. Apple supposedly hired two Google satellite executives, a guy named John Fenwick and Michael Trella, according to Bloomberg. This is according to Bloomberg. The assumption is that these two guys were brought in to work on imaging systems for probably Apple's mapping efforts, although it could be related to some communications technology. The reason it may be related to mapping is Apple recently applied for the ability to fly commercial drones to help with their mapping efforts, and these guys have some skill sets that would fit in there. Also, in 2015, Apple acquired a company called Ether Industries LLC. They develop near space technologies such as high bandwidth radio transceivers and high altitude balloons that take satellite-like images. Bloomberg also thinks the pair could be working on satellites for image collection or, again, satellites for communications. Why communications? Well, the satellites theory is also supported by the belief that Apple has been talking with Boeing about technology Boeing has been working on. Boeing has been working on sending more than 1,000 satellites into low Earth orbit for the purpose of building a broadband access service. So think about this. In remote regions, areas where you can't get broadband, you don't have access to cable modems or DSL, large parts of the world, Apple has a pretty good vested interest in getting connectivity to those areas so that they can sell more of their devices. Or, again, take it even further, maybe Apple's thinking about building their own network. This was something that was talked about in the early days when Apple was partnering up with carriers. Universal broadband access across the globe as a service. We know Apple's been working on their services business. Could be very, very interesting. Now, that's pure speculation on my part as to what they might be doing, but the fact that they're making these hires and that they're doing potentially talks with companies like Boeing about this kind of technology means there could be some pretty big things. And it could support a lot of their products and services, everything from Apple Music to the Apple Car. So I think in a lot of ways, it makes sense. And then we do have some interesting information from a report that Gizmodo was able to get their hands on related to what Apple might be doing in terms of future technology and augmented reality. They supposedly got their hands on a report compiled by an environmental health and safety contractor who was working for Apple. This got sent out to Apple employees, and in it, it details two health and safety incident reports of eye strain caused by some kind of prototype device that testers were working on. And the assumption is that this would be Apple's augmented reality glasses. We've heard rumors that a prototype exists and that Apple has these things, but this does seem to pretty definitively confirm that Apple is working on something and has prototypes that they're using with testers. One other interesting note from this report, an Apple Watch tester also had a knee injury that he suffered while skiing in Tahoe doing product testing. I know, what a rough job, right? You have to go skiing with an Apple Watch and get paid for it. I kind of think I want that guy's job. Even with the knee injury, I think I'd be okay with that. And then lastly, we talked a little bit last week about renewed reports of Apple's self-driving car project Titan. It looks like Apple had received approval from California to do testing of autonomous vehicles. In that filing, there's a lot of interesting and juicy details beyond just the fact that Apple is actually going to start testing a system. They list a number of people on the filing, and it includes a former NASA researcher who worked on developing an autonomous vehicle to explore one of Jupiter's moons. They also list three other engineers as possible testers, engineers from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So Apple hiring a lot of NASA engineers to help with their programs and efforts, everything from augmented reality to virtual reality to their self-driving car project. And a couple of the other engineers, they have experience working on systems for detection of 3D objects and motion planning algorithms. So that all ties in and fits really well with the autonomous vehicle project. And the filing lists a little bit about what kinds of tests Apple wants to be doing. They plan on doing low-speed driving tests, high-speed driving tests, tight U-turns, sudden steering input, sudden acceleration, sudden braking, and lane-changing tests up to 65 miles per hour. So they're going to be running these things pretty good. And it did, I think we mentioned this last time, it did mention that Apple will be using three modified 2015 Lexus SUVs to actually do their testing. So it does seem to confirm that at least for right now, Apple has some sort of platform that is going in existing vehicles, and Apple is not testing their own car design. It doesn't mean that Apple isn't working on their own car design, because this could just be the first phases, but everything has been indicating that Apple is more looking at developing some sort of platform or system and have moved away from actual, you know, developing their own autonomous vehicle. But that's kind of the latest with Apple's autonomous car. And then finally, one little quick report this week for future iPhones beyond the iPhone 8. Apple may be looking to move past OLED technology. I know, we're just getting OLED technology in the iPhone, and Apple already may be ready to move beyond it. And I say already with a grain of salt, because this information is coming out of their R&D lab in Taiwan. They've actually been researching micro LED technology as a potential replacement for LCD and OLED technologies. They've been doing that since 2016. And now we have a report from Korea saying that Apple may be getting ready to put the technology in a product, not into an iPhone yet, but the Apple Watch 3 may be Apple's first product to get micro LED technology. And that would make sense. The Apple Watch was the first technology from Apple that used an OLED screen. And the advantage of micro LED is that the displays can be thinner, lighter, and much more energy efficient, something that is, you know, as we know, critical for a device as small as the Apple Watch. And their move to the technology was likely helped along by their acquisition of the micro LED specialist LuxView, which was a company they acquired back in 2014. And it is eventually believed that Apple will move the tech into the iPhone, and that could happen sooner than some think. We're hearing maybe as early as 2019. So we might just have a 2017-2018 model of the iPhone with OLED and then move on to micro LED technology. So that is all of the latest from the world of Apple news. Now, before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that is Smile. I want to talk to you again about Text Expander for Teams. You use Text Expander for yourself, and you know how it benefits your productivity. It is a huge time saver, and we love it. So why not take the skills of Text Expander to your whole office or your whole work group with Text Expander for Teams? The ability to share and collaborate and organize your snippets can multiply everyone's productivity and really enhance your office automation. Your snippets get upgraded because, one, they can be worded by your best writers. You're able to share that. Why not get the best people writing snippets in your organization? We're not all really great at that, especially if you're writing customer service kinds of snippets and those sorts of things. Another advantage is your snippets become accessible and searchable. Everyone's snippets become accessible and searchable through simple abbreviations or keywords and shortcuts, so you can find just the snippets that you need for your work group or the members of your team. And it doesn't matter what platform your team is on either, because Text Expander for Teams is available for macOS, iOS devices, Windows, and the web, and you can mix and match as you like. So you're not tied down to any one device or any one platform. Let people use what they want to use and use Text Expander for Teams on top of it. And Text Expander also offers great support and posts on their website to help you better use the product. I would encourage you to go over and check out the Text Expander crossover series. They have great tips on using Text Expander to integrate with other applications like Evernote. There is a great example of some snippets that you can build to expand for things like meeting notes, research outlines, and journaling. So when you're getting into those meetings, you can quickly set up an outline and just start filling things out right inside Evernote using a quick Text Expander snippet. And April is Text Expander's first anniversary. So in that time, the Text Expander crew has added team statistics, group notes, public groups, monthly activity reports, the Windows app, and tons of client software updates, and much, much more. You can check it all out and help celebrate Text Expander's first anniversary by visiting textexpander.com/Maccast, and you can start a free trial. You can try it out completely free. Text Expander for Teams, textexpander.com/Maccast, and a big thank you to Text Expander and Smile for their continued support of the Maccast. I think I can safely say that no topic has ever come up on the Maccast, and nothing that I have said on the Maccast has ever garnered more feedback than my comments about the chapters and AAC version of the Maccast. I was kind of expressing some frustration with Apple, I think, on the last episode when we were talking about that? About the fact that they seem to have all but abandoned their format that they pioneered, the Apple Audio Codec, I think that's what it stands for, the AAC format, which allowed me to put in a really cool feature of the Maccast that apparently you love a lot, the chapter support. The ability to have chapter markers and changing album artwork and hyperlinks in the podcast, in iTunes or the podcast app as I'm saying things. And I have to tell you, a lot of the feedback that I received from you was exactly like this feedback from Mark.
Hey, Adam, it's Mark from Johannesburg, South Africa, a regular listener of your podcast. Thanks for always doing what you do each and every week. I'm like a kid in a candy store when it pops up on my phone that there's a new podcast. And one of the reasons why I love the podcast so much, besides the content, is the fact that you take the time and provide chapter points. Now, for a podcast listener who doesn't use the chapter points, it's all well and fine. But I'm sure there's many of your listeners, like myself, that absolutely love them for various reasons. And the thought that you may consider removing them just chilled me to my core. Because, number one, it gives me the opportunity to listen in a non-sequential order if I need to. I've got X amount of time in a car each and every day, and there's certain things I want to hear above others. So it's a nice way of skipping through the tracks and going backwards and forwards. Also, in South Africa, there's such lawlessness on the roads that often I'll get distracted by some idiot cutting me off, and I didn't really tune into the last few minutes of what you were saying. And just with a flick of a button on my steering wheel, I can go back a track and I can re-listen to the beginning of that section of your podcast. And also, in all reality, there's one or two topics that may not be within the realm of interest for me. For instance, Apple Pay, which we don't have in South Africa. So after a few moments of listening about Apple Pay, I might skip forward to the next track. So, chapter points. Essential? No, but it does break it into consumable chunks. It's such a great value add. I know I'm a sample of one, but I'm hoping I'm the voice of many. Please don't ever remove the chapter points. From South Africa, always great listening. Cheers, Adam.
Hey, Mark, thank you. Great voice, too. I love it when Mark sends in audio comments. But I have to tell you, your comments were echoed by many, so you were definitely the voice of many. There were many voices that chimed in on this topic, and I think I'd have to go back and listen to specifically what I said. I was ranting a little bit, let's be honest. Chapter markers were never really in danger of going away. Apparently, I said that I was going to, or had thought about, and I have thought about removing them in the past, never in any serious capacity. It's sort of a passing thought that goes through my mind because, being honest, it would simplify my workflow. I do have to do the extra work to get the chapters in there, and with Apple removing so much support, like when they removed support from GarageBand, it has made it more difficult. It's more challenging. I have a more complex, they've made my workflow more complex, and all of us like simpler workflows. I think that's natural. So the one thing that I was really, the one point I was really trying to make, and the one thing that I was really considering, is trying to get to a single format that supported chapters. My early hope was that AAC would take off and everybody would just support it as a podcast format because it does have better sound quality at lower bit rates and smaller file sizes, a big advantage in a lot of ways. Of course, it's an Apple format, so it never really got adopted. MP3 is still kind of the standard, and now MP3 does support chapters, and there are a lot of podcast apps that support MP3 chapters, and I'd love to exclusively use chapters in MP3 files. The problem is that iTunes and the podcast app do not support that. They only support chapters in AAC. So I'm in this dual format world right now, and that is fine. I will continue to do that. I, for all the reasons Mark mentioned and more, a lot of you mentioned the ability to go back and re-listen to segments of a podcast as being a huge advantage of the chapters, and I couldn't agree more. Some of you like the links. I know, I think the chapters are used more than, you know, looking at the artwork or the links, but all of those things in aggregate, as Mark, you so aptly pointed out, those are great value adds to the podcast. And it does set the MacCast apart and from other shows, and I think sets a standard for other shows to try to achieve. And more podcasts are incorporating, I've noticed, support for MP3 chapters. There's very few of us doing AAC. Probably could count the number of shows on one hand that do AAC chapters. But there are a lot of shows supporting, especially in the Mac world, supporting the MP3 chapters. So my point in sort of making that conversation is that I was really trying to inspire people to give feedback to Apple. Take a moment. All this great feedback that you sent me, if you could send that to apple.com/feedback and tell Apple you love and you want chapter support, you want support for chapters in the AAC format and podcasts, please tell them, because I really feel like they're abandoning the format. They haven't done anything with it. They haven't improved it. And as a matter of fact, they continue to have bugs that are AAC specific. Part of the reason why Marco mentioned removing AAC chapter support temporarily from his Overcast application was due to a bug. And I don't think anybody at Apple is really minding the store when it comes to the AAC format. They pulled out the chapter tools and the tools in GarageBand. There are no tools for it in Logic. We have to use third-party tools, and third-party developers are having a hard time with a lot of the APIs because they're really not supported. So if you really love this format and you want to see more of it, you want to see more podcasts using it, we need to get on Apple and tell them they need to support it. Either that, or if Apple doesn't want to do that, then add support for MP3 chapters into iTunes and into the iOS podcast app. Yeah, we'll lose some of the advantages of the audio quality, but at the very least, I'll be able to simplify my workflow into one file format, MP3, that's supported across everything. And that's sort of the holy grail for me at this point in terms of my workflow. So that's sort of what I was talking about. And thank you to everyone who sent in their feedback. I enjoyed hearing it and reading all of it. It was really great. And it just reaffirmed what I really already knew, that chapters are a really nice and important feature and something that truly makes the MacCast podcast unique. All right. This next thing I'm going to share with you, because it is a mystery to me. It is something, often when I get emails from you, I have an answer, or I can at least look up an answer or find an answer for you, something to share with you. Every once in a while, one of these things comes along and I am just completely stumped. The person who sent it in is completely stumped, and we need to turn to you, the MacCast community, to maybe help find an answer. I'm going to give you a theory. I think it's a good theory. I think I'm pretty close to the answer, and I may even have the right answer, but I also want to get your opinion and find out, you know, what I might be missing. I might be overlooking something totally obvious. So this came from Marty. He was in Indianapolis, Indiana, at an NBA playoff game. Congratulations, Marty. That's really cool. But he was at a game between the Indiana Pacers and the Cleveland Cavaliers. And he was taking a photo with his iPhone 6S running iOS 10.3.1. Something you'd want to do if you were at an NBA playoff game. The thing was, is when he got that image out and he looked at the GPS location data on the image where the photo was taken, it said it was taken at the Quicken Loans Arena in Cleveland, Ohio. Here's the thing, if you were listening earlier, he's in Indianapolis, Indiana. So why is it saying the photo was taken in Cleveland, a location that is 320 miles away, and the only clue is, well, that was the away team that was at the Indiana game, at the game in Indiana. So what's going on here? Is there some sort of weird Siri AI coming into play? GPS should be telling his phone where he is, and that should be where the data is coming from. Now, the first and most obvious guess, and maybe a guess that you would be at, is that there's something wrong with the GPS on Marty's phone, or maybe it just wasn't working at the time. And that's probably a likely scenario, Marty, because you're in a giant metal dome arena. You're indoors and you're surrounded by a lot of steel and metal. Chances are your GPS wasn't working, and very good chances are that maybe even your cell reception was blocked or impeded. And that becomes important because when there's no GPS signal, what your iPhone falls back on for getting location data is Wi-Fi or cell tower triangulation. So it probably couldn't use GPS, and it probably couldn't use cell tower triangulation, at least not very well. Maybe it could reach one tower, but it really needs three towers to be able to actually pinpoint exactly where you are. So why would it pinpoint you as being at the other team's home stadium, right? This is the mystery. And one of the things I thought about was, well, maybe the satellite uplinks for broadcast TV, I would assume they're broadcasting, you know, maybe the local stations from Cleveland are broadcasting out, and maybe it's going through their satellites, but that seemed a little bit odd. I thought, well, maybe Marty, you're just messing with me, that you're telling me this happened, but it really didn't. No, I don't think that's what's going on. No, but so what I kept coming back to, oh, and then I thought, well, you know, maybe you had been in Cleveland recently, but Marty told me, no, it's even stranger because he's never even ever visited Cleveland. His phone has never been in Cleveland. None of that's going on. So that just had me coming back to, okay, no cell signal, potentially no or poor cell signal, no access to GPS. The phone's going to fall back on Wi-Fi. So here I'm left with Wi-Fi. And I was reminded about a story that I heard on a podcast that I listened to called Reply All about this really weird thing that was happening to a poor couple in Atlanta, related to GPS and Find My iPhone. They were having all these people show up at their house saying, you have my phone. Someone stole my phone, or you stole my phone. My phone is at your house. I know this because it showed up here on Find My iPhone. And literally hundreds of lost phones were being pinpointed to their house, this one location in Atlanta. And it was... You know, why was that happening? And it turned out when they did some investigating that what they discovered was this couple lived in what they called a digital desert, basically an area where there were very few Wi-Fi hotspots, nothing in their immediate area. So most of us, if you live in a populated area, you have Wi-Fi hotspots all around you. Here, they had very, very few. And when your device can't get, as we mentioned, a GPS or a cell tower signal, when it's blocked by a giant metal building or something like that, it falls back on routers. And it looks up router locations based on the IP address that's assigned to the device. And it looks for the nearest Wi-Fi network it can detect. And the IP addresses that it resolves to are from the last locations where those devices were connected to Wi-Fi, and they're looked up against a database that is maintained by a couple different companies, Neustar, MaxMind, Skyhook, and their software is embedded into millions of apps and phones. And why that's important is that location can be, again, it's the last Wi-Fi location that the device was connected to. So that information can be wrong or way off at times. And the only other parallel I could draw personally to Marty's situation was I have had a number of photos in my own photo library that all ended up in a single GPS location where they were not taken. Now, in my case, it turns out the location was fairly near my house. It was, you know, several miles away, but it kind of made sense. And I think it's the same sort of scenario. I think these were photos that I had taken probably when I was out and about near my house. And for whatever reason, I didn't have a Wi-Fi or GPS signal. So it fell back to the IP address of my iPhone and then connected to, it mapped in the database to this one weird location. So I think this is what happened. So it gets back to, I think, what the last question is. Well, then why Cleveland? And I was thinking about this a lot. And the conclusion that I've come to is there's probably at the game a lot of fans from Cleveland visiting Indianapolis. It's not that far away. It's relatively close geographically. And I have a feeling a lot of them maybe had mobile Wi-Fi hotspot connections on and active on their devices. So when your device wasn't able to get a GPS signal and it wasn't able to get a cell signal, it tried to connect to all of those nearby Wi-Fi devices. And guess what? Those probably had IP addresses that mapped back in that database to Cleveland. Now, why specifically to the visiting team's home stadium? That could just be a coincidence. I don't really know. But that's my theory. I think it's pretty solid. But what do you think? Am I missing something obvious here? Or is this the mystery of the wrong GPS location on a photo? And share your stories. If you've noticed this in your own experiences, share some of your stories and things with us. And give me your feedback, maccast@gmail.com. All right, here's another thing that I got to experience recently. It has to do with iOS and text support and screen sharing, but I'm going to let Gary, who sent me this comment and question, tell you about it first.
Hey, Adam, Gary. I wanted to bring something up, like the screen sharing for Mac computers and even computers in general. I know I mentioned it a while back that the iOS devices don't really have a good screen sharing ability. You can use programs like TeamViewer to view into other computers, so you can do a screen share into them, but not the other way. You can't view the iPad from another device. And I think that's largely security-based. They don't want to have a hole like that for people to exploit. Well, in thinking about it further, I think it just seems natural that that happens at some point. I know on the Mac now, you can go into iCloud to your messages and choose someone that's on a Mac to share a screen. And you can share that with the ability to use the screen or just observe the screen. I thought that would be something somewhat perfect to extend to iPad, iPhone. And that just seems like a natural evolution. I know that right now you can actually record a screen or view a screen for a person. Say you call a family member and say, let's do it together. Can you plug your iPad or iPhone into your Mac if they have one? And this is becoming more and more or less the case. Plug it into your Mac and then open QuickTime, and you can choose, I think it's record a video or something like that, and it will show you the different inputs, one of them being the screen of the iPad or iPhone that's connected. Then you could use that other product like the iMessage screen sharing through the Mac to view that. It's a little bit of a workaround, but it does work. I just wanted to get your feedback on the latter of being able to have iMessage extend to iPhones, iPads, obviously with permission. If it's secure enough to extend to the Mac, I would think it should be secure enough to extend to iPad, iPhone. And I also did have a call with Apple Tech Support where they actually did that on my devices. I think they added a security certificate that may have made it possible, but I think they just sent me a code or something. So I know it does exist. I just don't know at what point they will make it available to all of us. Thanks, Adam.
Hey, Gary, I think you're spot on. I think this is a feature that a lot of us would really like and enjoy and would hope that Apple extends to our iOS devices. And as you aptly pointed out, and I got to have this experience recently with Apple Support myself, where they have the ability to not only remotely view an iPhone during a support call. And I think what they did is they just sent me a text link. I want to say it was a link in a text message, and I just clicked on it, authorized that, yes, they're going to have access to my device. And there might have even been a little indicator up at the top, I think, that showed that they were viewing my screen. I think you get a bar or something, and then I could tap that, and then it would give me the option to stop or end the sharing session. But once I clicked that link and enabled and said, okay, they can share my screen, they were able to not only view it, but even could control a pointer where they could point to different parts of my screen and show me what to click on and where to go. It was a pretty amazing experience. And for a lot of us a lot of you who are listening to this show, you know we're the tech support for our friends and family. So to have this kind of tool, absolutely, this is something I think we all would love to have. And it looks like, to me, it's built into the operating system, at least at some level. So the idea that Apple should open this up, I think, is a good one. I think they absolutely should open this up. I also like, Gary, your mentions of the workaround of using screen capture in QuickTime to just hard connect an iOS device to a Mac and then use the screen sharing feature in Messages to actually share the screen. I will point out another way you could possibly do this. One of my favorite apps, I use it a lot when I'm presenting to user groups. When I have my Mac hooked up to a projector and I need to display something on my iOS device, I use an app called Reflector, Reflector 2. And it has the ability to AirPlay mirror your device to your Mac. And I think I've heard and read reports that the next version of macOS is probably going to have this functionality built in where you will be able to set up your Mac as an AirPlay receiver. But it basically becomes an AirPlay receiver, and so you could, again, do that and then use a screen sharing app like Messages or Skype also offers screen sharing to actually share your iPad or your iOS screen. And not only that, Reflector also has the ability to do a live YouTube broadcast. So if you have a Gmail or a Google YouTube account, you could set up a live broadcast and you could do it as a private broadcast or as sort of just an obfuscated, you know, link. And then you could just share and broadcast and then send someone the link to your live YouTube broadcast. You can also broadcast publicly using the tool, and you can send not only the screen of your iOS device, but you could also send your video and audio from your built-in mic and iSight camera. So that's another way you could maybe handle this and do a little remote tech support with iOS. But yeah, I think your comments are spot on. I think this is a tool that I would hope Apple would eventually open up to all of us and not just keep for themselves. And then finally for today, I want to get into a little more detail about the issue I was having that caused Apple support to even use the screen sharing feature with me. Because I think I talked about this on the iOS show podcast, but I went back through my show notes and I don't believe that I brought this up on the MacCast. And I finally now have a complete story here to tell you about some trouble that I was having with my Apple Watch. And I think it might help some of you out because I found out through trying to get some community support on Twitter that I wasn't alone in having the problem that I had, and a lot of people didn't know what the resolution was. So what was going on is my Apple Watch, I was having this very strange, weird issue with the heart rate sensor. So if you have an Apple Watch, you probably know it has a heart rate sensor built into it, and there is a heart rate app that you can launch. So you can go in and you can tap the app, and when you launch it, it is a very simple app. What it does is it turns on the heart rate sensor, it starts to monitor your heart rate live and in real time, and then on the screen after a second or two, it will start to show the number of beats per minute that your heart rate is going at, and then it logs that data into the health app and into the health kit data, which is synced over to your iPhone. And I was having this really weird issue where I could launch the app, but it would not display my heart rate live and in real time. But if I would quit the app and come back to it, I could see that it was actually recording and capturing my heart rate data. And that heart rate data would actually sync over to HealthKit. It would appear in HealthKit. Also, other apps that would use the heart rate sensor and display live heart rate data, those were actually working. It would show my heart rate on the screen. It was fine. So I was fairly certain that the heart rate sensor was not broken, that it was working. It seemed to be some sort of disconnect between the software and the hardware. And I tried everything. I tried completely erasing and restoring my Apple Watch, which you do by completely unpairing it. I tried restoring from backup, also setting it up as new. I even went so far as to completely erase and restore my iPhone, restore it from backup, erase and restore my iPhone, setting it up as new, setting up both devices up as new, and nothing seemed to resolve this weird, quirky problem. And finally, I ended up calling Apple support. I sent in my, I went to the Genius Bar. The Genius verified that I was having the issue, thought it was weird enough to actually send in my Apple Watch for repair. I waited for it to come back from repair. When they received it in the repair center, they said, we couldn't find anything wrong with it. We couldn't duplicate it, despite the fact that I duplicated it right there for the Genius. I was a little bit frustrated. I got back on the phone with Apple support. I got a really great Apple support technician. He did the whole remote thing. We used the camera on my iPhone so I could show him the issue that I was having, let him know I wasn't crazy. I wasn't just imagining it. And he again verified, yep, you have the problem. He put it in order, and they actually replaced my Apple Watch. And when I got the replacement hardware, I thought, okay, that's it. It's going to be resolved. Nope. I had exactly the same problem. And there was one little hint that finally, or actually two hints that finally got me to figure out what the problem was. The first was there is a way to force quit an app, a background app that's running on your Apple Watch. A lot of people don't know this, but if you open up the app and then you press and hold the button on your Apple Watch until you get the power off screen, then you press and hold the digital crown, whatever app was the currently running app, that will be force quit and you'll be returned back to the app launcher. So every time I would do that with the heart rate sensor app open and reopen it, it would briefly display and look like it was working, displaying my what I thought was my heart rate. But it turned out it was 79 beats per minute every time, and it never changed. It was like stuck on that. And then it would go back to being broken. So that was one little clue, and it was really odd. I thought, you know, there's something stuck in there. There's some kind of data stuck in there, but I didn't know how to clear it or get rid of it. And it didn't, you know, restoring the Apple Watch and setting it up as new didn't clear that. So it didn't make sense. I thought there must be some sort of software bug, yet other people were telling me everything was working fine for them. So finally, I shot an Apple Clips video and I posted it on Twitter to try and get help from the community. And finally, one person came back and said, you know, I had this exact same issue with my Apple Watch, and the only way I could resolve it was erasing everything and setting everything up as new. And I guess I hadn't gone as far as setting up my iPhone as new, because that's just a painful process. So I said I did that earlier. I hadn't tried that yet. It was my last resort. I was getting to that point, and this person actually was recommending doing that. And then that got me thinking, okay, so there's some kind of data on my iPhone related to heart rate that must need to get cleared out in order to resolve this problem. And I thought the only place that that could be would be in the HealthKit data. So I went into the health app on my iPhone. I went into the heart rate sensor data, and I looked at the history, and lo and behold, what I found was three entries that were set for the future. It was like my Apple Watch had predicted what my heart rate was going to be in 2021, 2023, and 2026. And more interesting, all of those heart rates were recorded on the same day and at the same time, just in different years. I thought, okay, this is really weird. So I manually deleted those entries. I unpaired and repaired my Apple Watch. I set it up as new, and guess what? The heart rate sensor started working again. So now the only final mystery that I was left with was, how did that data get in there? How did I get future heart rate data into my Apple Watch? And I was puzzled about that until I talked with Jeff Butts at the Mac Observer. And he said, hey, do your kids ever use your iPhone? And I thought that was a weird question with how to resolve this problem, or how, you know, future heart rate data got into my iPhone. Like, did they time travel and put it on their wrist? And no, what he was asking me about was, he said, you know, because I know that there's games where sometimes to get through a level of the game, you have to change the date time on your device. And I said, nope, it wasn't my kids. It was actually me, because, you know, one of my picks of the week was a great application, a game called Black Box. And one of the things that you have to do in some of the puzzles for Black Box is actually exactly that. You have to go in and manually adjust your date and time. So the chronology of what happened to break my Apple Watch heart rate sensor was I was playing this game at one point, and I had manually changed the date time on my Apple Watch. And guess what? It recorded my heart rate sensor. It put that data into the health application. It was locked in there, and that ultimately resulted in the heart rate application on the Apple Watch not working. You wouldn't think that data would be impacted for live real-time data, but there's a small bug in there that affected that. So luckily, I was able to get back to my Apple support guy. I shared all this information with him. I also filed a bug report with Apple, so hopefully this will get resolved in future versions of Apple Watch. But if you have this problem with your heart rate sensor on your Apple Watch, there you go. Go look at the data and see if you don't have a similar kind of situation. And you probably can fix your Apple Watch without having to do a full erase and setup as new of your iPhone. So hopefully, I know it's a real weird edge case, but a couple people on Twitter mentioned having a similar problem. So if you've had this problem, hopefully that last little bit of information helps you out. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile and Text Expander. Check out Text Expander for Teams. Also, check out all of Smile's other great applications, Text Expander for Mac, Text Expander for iOS, PDF Pen for iPhone, iPad, and Mac, and also PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information, details on all of Smile's great applications at smilesoftware.com/MacCast, and also get your free trial of Text Expander for Teams at textexpander.com/MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on this or a future episode of the MacCast, I welcome your emails, your audio comments. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave voicemail messages there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, check out the MacCast forum. We recently did an upgrade. We've got new conversations going on the forum. It is a great place to get tech support and help from members of the MacCast community. It's totally free to sign up for an account. You can check that out at forum.maccast.com. I know we've got social media, we've got Facebook and Twitter, and here I am trying to bring back the bulletin board system. You got to rock the old school technology. Go check it out. It's actually really pretty cool. If you want to follow me online between shows, you can find me on the social medias. I'm at Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And we also have a community on Google. You can find it through my Google Plus account, which is google.com/plusMacCast. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.